This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Day by Elie Wiesel, translated from the French by Anne Borchardt, and narrated by George Guidel. This book is copyrighted 1962 and 2006 by Elie Wiesel. This translation is copyrighted 1990 by Elie Wiesel. And this recording is copyrighted 1992 by Recorded Books. As the final installment in Elie Wiesel's Holocaust trilogy, Le Jour, translated as Day, was initially entitled The Accident when first published in English, we open here with an updated preface to this new edition, having also restored the title the author originally intended.
Preface. Day is my second novel and third book. In a concrete sense, it is the sequel to Dawn. Do the two stories bring the same character to life? You might say that each can be found in the other. This novel deals with a number of obvious themes, but its true subject remains unspoken. Having survived the cruelest of wars, how does one go on in a hostile or indifferent world? Stripped of everything resembling a normal existence, having lost everything except his memory, my hero suffers from an inability to count on the future, to become attached to another person, thus to hope. One evening, crossing Times Square in Manhattan, he is hit by a taxi. In his hospital bed, he spends weeks battling the pain from his multiple injuries. Battling death, life too. Wavering between these two callings, each as brutal as the other, he lives through old fears and memories again. He struggles to understand why fate has spared him and not so many others. Was it to know happiness? His happiness will never be complete. To know love? He will never be sure of being worthy of love. A part of him is still back there on the other side, where the dead deny the living the right to leave them behind. His recovery will be a road into exile, a journey in which the touch of the woman he loves will matter less than the image of his grandmother buried under a mountain of ashes. After night comes day, inviting the dead to seek an open heart in which to find rest, an emissary who may become an ally, a friend. This is the novel's theme, set within the background of what is so poorly called the Holocaust. The novel does not deal directly with the event. As I have said elsewhere, I feel unable to tell the story of this event, much less imagine it. A novel about Auschwitz is not a novel, or else it is not about Auschwitz. That said, certain episodes here are true, that is, taken from life. The accident actually happened to me. I didn't see the taxi coming. The possibility of a suicidal impulse was invented for the sake of the story. In fact, the question has haunted me for a long time. Does life have meaning after Auschwitz? In a universe cursed because it is guilty, is hope still possible? For a young survivor whose knowledge of life and death surpasses that of his elders, wouldn't suicide be as great a temptation as love or faith? Many years ago, long after publishing this short narrative, I read somewhere, I think it was in a book by Michael Elkins, about the tragedy of children and adolescents who had emerged from hiding in forests and underground shelters at the time of the liberation, who soon fell ill from exhaustion or malnutrition. Transported to various hospitals, they baffled doctors with their refusal to be fed, choosing instead to let themselves slip into death. This was their simple and heart-rending way of launching their own accusation at a so-called civilized society that had allowed people to stand by idly and betray the very humanity of mankind by remaining indifferent. The suicides of these children, like the murders of their parents, will never be forgiven. Elie Wiesel.
The accident occurred on an evening in July, right in the heart of New York, as Kathleen and I were crossing the street to go to see the movie The Brothers Karamazov. The heat was heavy, suffocating. It penetrated your bones, your veins, your lungs. It was difficult to speak, even to breathe. Everything was covered with an enormous, wet sheet of air. The heat stuck to your skin, like a curse. People walked clumsily, looking haggard, their mouths dry, like the mouths of old men watching the decay of their existence. Old men hoping to take leave of their own beings so as not to go mad. Their bodies filled them with disgust. I was tired. I had just finished my work, a 500-word cable. 500 words, to say nothing. To cover up another empty day, it was one of those quiet and monotonous Sundays that leave no mark on time. Washington, nothing. United Nations, nothing. New York, nothing. Even Hollywood said nothing. The movie stars had deserted the news. It wasn't easy to use 500 words to say that there was nothing to say. After 2 hours of hard work, I was exhausted. "What shall we do now?" Kathleen asked. "Whatever you like," I answered. We were on the corner of 45th Street, right in front of the Sheraton Astor. I felt stunned, heavy, a thick fog in my head. The slightest gesture was like trying to lift a planet. There was lead in my arms, in my legs. To my right, I could see the human whirlwind on Times Square. People go there as they go to the sea, neither to fight boredom nor the anguish of a room filled with blighted dreams, but to feel less alone, or more alone. The world turned in slow motion under the weight of the heat. The picture seemed unreal. Beneath the colorful neon carnival, people went back and forth, laughing, singing, shouting, insulting one another, all of this with an exasperating slowness. 3 sailors had come out of the hotel. When they saw Kathleen, they stopped short and, in unison, gave a long, admiring whistle. "Let's go," Kathleen said, pulling me by the arm. She was obviously annoyed. "What do you have against them?" I asked. "They think you're beautiful." "I don't like them to whistle like that," I said in a professorial tone. "It's their way of looking at a woman. They see her with their mouths and not with their eyes. Sailors keep their eyes for the sea. When they're on land, they leave their eyes behind, as tokens of love." The 3 admirers had already been gone for quite some time. "And you?" Kathleen asked. "How do you look at me?" She liked to relate everything to us. We were always the center of her universe, for her other mortals lived only to be used as comparisons. I don't look at you," I answered, slightly annoyed. There was a silence. I was biting my tongue. "But I love you. You know that." "You love me, but you don't look at me?" she asked gloomily. "Thanks for the compliment." "You don't understand," I went right on. "One doesn't necessarily exclude the other. You can love God, but you can't look at him." She seemed satisfied with this comparison. I would have to practice lying. "Whom do you look at when you love God?" she asked after a moment of silence. "Yourself. If man could contemplate the face of God, he would stop loving him. God needs love. He does not need understanding." "And you?" For Kathleen, even God was not so much a subject for discussion as a way to bring the conversation back to us. I, too, I need your love. We were still in the same spot. Why hadn't we moved? I don't know. Perhaps we were waiting for the accident. I'll have to learn to lie, I kept thinking, even for the short time I have left. To lie well, without blushing. Until then I had been lying much too badly. I was awkward. My face would betray me, and I would start blushing. What are we waiting for? Kathleen was getting impatient. Nothing, I said. I was lying without knowing it. We were waiting for the accident. You still aren't hungry? No, I answered. But you haven't eaten anything all day, she said reproachfully. No. Kathleen sighed. How long do you think you can hold out? You're slowly killing yourself. There was a small restaurant nearby. We went in. All right, I told myself, I'll also have to learn to eat and to love. You can learn anything. 10 or 12 people sitting on high red stools were eating silently at the counter. Kathleen now found herself in the crossfire of their stares. She was beautiful. Her face, especially around the lips, showed the first signs of a fear that was waiting for a chance to turn into live suffering. I would have liked to tell her once more that I loved her. We ordered 2 hamburgers and 2 glasses of grapefruit juice. Eat, Kathleen said, and she looked up at me pleadingly. I cut off a piece and lifted it to my mouth. The smell of blood turned my stomach. I felt like throwing up. Once I had seen a man eating with great appetite a slice of meat without bread. Starving, I watched him for a long time. As if hypnotized, I followed the motion of his fingers and jaws. I was hoping that if he saw me there in front of him, he would throw me a piece. He didn't look up. The next day, he was hanged by those who shared his barracks. He had been eating human flesh. To defend himself, he had screamed, "I didn't do any harm, he was already dead." When I saw his body swinging in the latrine, I wondered, what if he had seen me? Eat, Kathleen said. I swallowed some juice. I'm not hungry, I said with an effort. A few hours later, the doctors told Kathleen, "He's lucky, he'll suffer less because his stomach is empty. He won't vomit so much." Let's go, I told Kathleen as I turned to leave. I could feel it. Another minute there and I'd faint. I paid for the hamburgers and we left. Times Square hadn't changed. False lights, artificial shadows. The same anonymous crowd twisting and untwisting. In the bars and in the stores, the same rock and roll tunes hitting away at your temples with thousands of invisible little hammers. The neon signs still announced that to drink this or that was good for your health, for happiness, for the peace of the world, of the soul, and of I don't know what else. "Where would you like to go?" Kathleen inquired. She pretended not to have noticed how pale I was. Who knows, I thought. She too, perhaps, will learn how to lie. "Far," I answered. "Very far." "I'll go with you," she declared. The sadness and bitterness of her voice filled me with pity. "Kathleen has changed," I told myself. "She who believed in defiance, in fighting, in hatred, had now chosen to submit. She who refused to follow any call that didn't come from herself, now recognized defeat. I knew that our suffering changes us, but I didn't know that it could also destroy others. "Of course," I said, "I won't go without you." I was thinking to go far away, where the roads leading to simplicity are known not merely to a select group, but to all. Where love, laughter, songs, and prayers carry with them neither anger nor shame. Where I can think about myself without anguish, without contempt. Where the wine, Kathleen, is pure and not mixed with the spit of corpses. Where the dead live in cemeteries and not in the hearts and memories of men. "Well," Kathleen asked, pursuing her idea, "where shall we go? We can't stand here all night." "Let's go to the movies," I said. It was still the best place. We wouldn't be alone. We would think about something else. We would be somewhere else. Kathleen agreed. She would have preferred to go back to my place or to hers, but she understood my objection. It would be too hot, while the movie would be air-conditioned. I came to the conclusion that it wasn't so hard to lie. "What shall we see?" Kathleen looked around her, at the theaters that surround Times Square. Then she exclaimed excitedly, "The Brothers Karamazov! Let's see The Brothers Karamazov!" It was playing on the other side of the square. We would have to cross two avenues. An ocean of cars and noises separated us from the movie. "I'd rather see some other picture," I said. "I like Dostoevsky too much." Kathleen insisted. "It was a good, great, extraordinary movie. Yul Brynner as Dmitri. It was a picture one had to see." "I'd rather see an ordinary mystery," I said. "Something without philosophy, without metaphysics. It's too hot for intellectual exercises. Look, Murder in Rio is playing on this side. Let's go to that. I'd love to know how they commit murders in Brazil." Kathleen was stubborn. Once again she wanted to test our love. If Dostoevsky won, I loved her. Otherwise I didn't. I glanced at her. Still the fear around her lips, the fear that was going to become suffering. Kathleen was beautiful when she suffered. Her eyes were deeper, her voice warmer, fuller. Her dark beauty was simpler and more human. Her suffering had a quality of saintliness. It was her way of offering herself. I couldn't see Kathleen suffer without telling her I loved her, as if love was the negation of evil. I had to stop her suffering. "You really care that much?" I asked her. "You're really that anxious to see the good Brothers Karamazov mistreated?" Apparently she was. It was Yul Brynner or our love. "In that case, let's go." A triumphant smile that lasted only a second lit up her face. Her fingers gripped my arm as if to say, "Now I believe in what is happening to us." We took three or four steps to the edge of the sidewalk. We had to wait a little, wait for the red light to become green, for the flow of cars to stop, for the policeman who was directing traffic to raise his hand, for the cab driver, unaware of the role he was going to play in a moment, to reach the appointed spot. We had to wait for the director's cue. I turned around. The clock in the TWA window said 10:25. Come on, Kathleen decided, pulling me by the arm. It's green. We started to cross the street. Kathleen was walking faster than I. She was on my right, a few inches ahead of me at most. The brothers Karamazov weren't very far away anymore. But I didn't see them that night. What did I hear first? The grotesque screeching of brakes, or the shrill scream of a woman? I no longer remember. When I came to, for a fraction of a second, I was lying on my back in the middle of the street. In a tarnished mirror, a multitude of heads were bending over me. There were heads everywhere, right, left, above, and even underneath. All of them alike. The same wide-open eyes reflecting fright and curiosity. The same lips whispering the same incomprehensible words. An elderly man seemed to be saying something to me. I think it was not to move. He had close-cropped hair and a mustache. Kathleen no longer had the beautiful black hair that she was so proud of. Disfigured, her face had lost its youth. Her eyes, as if in the presence of death, had grown larger, and, incredibly enough, she had grown a mustache. A dream, I told myself, just a dream that I'll forget when I wake up. Otherwise, why should I be here on the pavement? Why would these people be around me as if I were going to die? And why would Kathleen suddenly have a mustache? Noises, coming from all directions, bounced against a curtain of fog they weren't able to penetrate. I couldn't make out anything that was being said. I would have liked to tell them not to talk, because I couldn't hear them. I was dreaming while they were not. But I was unable to utter the slightest sound. The dream had made me deaf and mute. A poem by Dylan Thomas, always the same one, kept coming back to me, about not going gently into the night, but to rage, rage against the dying of the light. Scream? Deaf mutes don't scream. They go gently into the night, lightly, timidly. They don't scream against the dying of the light. They can't. Their mouths are full of blood. It's useless to scream when your mouth is filled with blood. People see the blood but cannot hear you scream. That's why I was silent. And also, because I was dreaming of a summer night when my body was frozen. The heat was sickening, the faces bent over me streaming with sweat, sweat falling in rhythmical drops, and yet I was dreaming that I was so cold I was dying. How can one cry out against a dream? How can one scream against the dying of the light, against life that grows cold, against blood flowing out? It was only later, much later, when I was already out of danger, that Kathleen told me about the circumstances surrounding the accident. A speeding cab, approaching from the left, had caught me, dragging me several yards. Kathleen had suddenly heard the screeching of brakes and a woman's shrill scream. She barely had time to turn around before a crowd was already surrounding me. She didn't know at first that I was the man lying at the spectator's feet. Then, having a strong feeling that it was I, she pushed her way through and saw me. Crushed with pain, curled up, my head between my knees. And the people were talking, talking endlessly. "He's dead," one of them said. "No, he's not. Look, he's moving." Preceded by the sound of sirens, the ambulance arrived within 20 minutes. During that time I showed few signs of life. I didn't cry, I didn't moan, I didn't say anything. In the ambulance I came to several times for a few seconds. During these brief moments I gave Kathleen astonishingly precise instructions about things I wanted her to do for me, inform the paper, call one of my friends and ask him to replace me temporarily, cancel various appointments, pay the rent, the phone bill, the laundry. Having handed her the last of these immediate problems, I closed my eyes and didn't open them again for 5 days. Kathleen also told me this. The first hospital to which the ambulance took me refused to let me in. There wasn't any room. All the beds were taken. At least, that's what they said. But Kathleen thought it was just a pretext. The doctors, after one glance at me, had decided there was no hope. It was better to be rid of a dying man as fast as possible. The ambulance drove on to New York Hospital. Here, it seemed, they weren't afraid of the dying. The doctor on duty, a composed and sympathetic-looking young resident, immediately took care of me while trying to make a diagnosis. "Well, doctor?" Kathleen had asked. Through some miracle, she hadn't been sent out of the emergency room while Dr. Paul Russell was taking care of me. "At first sight, it looks rather bad," the young doctor answered. And he explained in a professional tone, "All the bones on the left side of his body are broken. Internal hemorrhage, brain concussion. I can't tell about his eyes yet whether they'll be affected or not. The same for his brain. Let's hope it hasn't been damaged." Kathleen tried not to cry. "What can be done, doctor?"
"Pray."
"Is it that serious?"
"Very serious."
The young doctor, whose voice was as restrained as an old man's, looked at her for a moment, then asked,
"Who are you?"
"His wife?" On the verge of hysteria, Kathleen just shook her head to say no.
"His fiancée?"
"No," she whispered.
"His girlfriend?"
"Yes." After hesitating a moment, he had asked her softly, "Do you love him?"
"Yes,"
Kathleen whispered.
"In that case, there are good reasons not to lose hope. Love is worth as much as prayer, sometimes more."
Then Kathleen burst into tears. After 3 days of consulting and waiting, the doctors decided that it was worth trying surgery after all. In any case, I didn't have much to lose. On the other hand, with luck, if all went well, the operation lasted a long time, more than 5 hours. 2 surgeons had to take turns. My pulse fell dangerously low. I was almost given up for dead. With blood transfusions, shots, and oxygen, they brought me back to life. Finally, the surgeons decided to limit the operation to the hip. The ankle, the ribs, and the other small fractures could wait. The vital thing for the time being was to stop the bleeding, sew together the torn arteries, and close the incision. I was brought back to my room, and for 2 days swung between life and death. Dr. Russell, who was devotedly taking care of me, was still pessimistic about the final result. My fever was too high, and I was losing too much blood. On the 5th day, I at last regained consciousness. I'll always remember. I opened my eyes and had to close them right away because I was blinded by the whiteness of the room. A few minutes went by before I could open them again and locate myself in time and space. On both sides of my bed there were bottles of plasma hanging from the wall. I couldn't move my arms. 2 big needles were fastened to them with surgical tape. Everything was ready for an emergency transfusion. I tried to move my legs. My body no longer obeyed me. I felt a sudden fear of being paralyzed. I made a superhuman effort to shout, to call a nurse, a doctor, a human being, to ask for the truth. But I was too weak. The sounds stuck in my throat. Maybe I've lost my voice, too, I thought. I felt alone, abandoned. Deep inside, I discovered a regret. I would have preferred to die. An hour later, Dr. Russell came into the room and told me I was going to live. My legs were not going to be amputated. I couldn't move them because they were in a cast that covered my whole body. Only my head, my arms, my toes were visible. "You've come back from very far," the young doctor said. I didn't answer. I still felt regret at having come back from so far. "You must thank God," he went on. I looked at him more carefully. Sitting on the edge of my bed, his fingers intertwined, his eyes were filled with an intense curiosity. "How does one thank God?" I asked him. My voice was only a whisper, but I was able to speak. This filled me with such joy that tears came to my eyes. That I was still alive had left me indifferent, or nearly so, but the knowledge that I could still speak filled me with an emotion that I couldn't hide. The doctor had a wrinkled baby face. He was blonde. His light blue eyes showed a great deal of goodness. He was looking at me very attentively. But this didn't bother me. I was too weak. "How does one thank God?" I repeated. I would have liked to add, "Why thank him?" I had not been able to understand for a long time what in the world God had done to deserve man. The doctor continued to look at me closely, very closely. A strange gleam, perhaps a strange shadow, was in his eyes. Suddenly my heart jumped. Frightened, I thought, "He knows something." "Are you cold?" he asked, still looking at me. "Yes," I answered, worried. "I'm cold." My body was trembling. "It's your fever," he explained. "Usually they take your pulse, or else they touch your forehead with the back of their hand." He did nothing. He knew. "We'll try to fight the fever," he went on sententiously. "We'll give you shots, many shots, penicillin, every hour, day and night. The enemy, now, is fever." He stopped talking and looked at me for a long time before going on. He seemed to be looking for a sign, an indication, a solution to a problem whose particulars I couldn't guess. "We're afraid of infection," he continued. "If the fever goes up, you're lost." "And the enemy will be victorious," I said in a tone of voice that intended irony. "You see, doctor, what people say is true. Man carries his fiercest enemy within himself. Hell isn't others, it's ourselves. Hell is the burning fever that makes you feel cold. An indefinable bond had grown between us. We were speaking the mature language of men who are in direct contact with death. I tried to put on a smile, but being too cold, I could only manage a grin. That's one reason why I don't like winter. Smiles become abstract. Dr. Russell got up. "I'll send the nurse. It's time for a shot." He was touching his lips with his fingers, as if to think better, and then added, "When you feel better, we'll have a lot to talk about." Again, I had the uncomfortable impression that he knew, or at least that he suspected, something. I closed my eyes. Suddenly, I became conscious of the pain that was torturing me. I hadn't realized it before, and yet the suffering was there. It was the air I was breathing, the words forming in my brain, the cast that covered my body like a flaming skin. How had I managed to remain unaware of it until then? Perhaps I had been too absorbed in the conversation with the doctor. Did he know I was suffering? Suffering horribly. Did he know I was cold? Did he know that the suffering was burning my flesh and that at the same time I was shaking with an unbearable cold, as if I were being plunged first into a furnace and then into an icy tub? Apparently he did. He knew. Paul Russell was a perceptive doctor. He could see me biting my lips furiously. "You're in pain," he stated. He was standing motionless at the foot of my bed. I was ashamed that my teeth were chattering in his presence. "It's normal," he went on without waiting for an answer. "You're covered with wounds. Your body's rebelling. Pain is your body's way of protesting. But I told you suffering is not the enemy. The fever is. If it goes up, you're lost." Death. I was thinking, he thinks that death is my enemy. He's mistaken. Death is not my enemy. If he doesn't know that, he knows nothing. Or at least, he doesn't know everything. He has seen me come back to life, but he doesn't know what I think of life and death. Or could he possibly know and not show it? Doubt, like the insistent buzz of a bee inside me, was putting my nerves on edge. I could feel the fever as it spread, seize me by the hair, which seemed like a burning torch. The fever was throwing me from one world into another, up and down, very high up and very far down, as if it meant to teach me the cold of high places and the heat of abysses. "Would you like a sedative?" the doctor inquired. I shook my head. No, I didn't want any. I didn't need any. I wasn't afraid. I heard his steps moving toward the door, which must have been somewhere behind me. Let him go, I thought. I'm not afraid of being alone, of walking the distance between life and death. No, I don't need him. I'm not afraid. Let him go. He opened the door, hesitated before closing it. He stopped. Was he going to come back? "Incidentally," he said softly, so softly I could hardly hear him, "incidentally, I nearly forgot to tell you. Kathleen, she's an extremely charming young woman. Extremely charming." With that, he quietly left the room. Now I was alone. Alone as only a paralyzed and suffering man can be. Soon the nurse would come with her penicillin to fight the enemy. It was maddening to fight the enemy with an injection, with the help of a nurse. It was laughable. But I didn't laugh. The muscles in my face were motionless, frozen. The nurse was going to come soon, that's what the young doctor had said. The doctor whose calm voice was like an old man's, having just discovered that human goodness carries its own reward. What else had he told me? Something about Kathleen. Yes, he had mentioned her name. Charming young woman. No, not that. He had said something else. Extremely charming. Yes, that's it. That's what he had said. Kathleen is a charming young woman. I remembered perfectly. Extremely charming. Kathleen. Where could she be now? In what world? In the one above or the one below? I hope she won't come. I hope she won't appear in this room. I don't want her to see me like this. I hope she won't come with the nurse. I hope she won't become a nurse, and that she won't give me penicillin. I don't want her help in my fight against the enemy. She's a charming girl, extremely charming. But she doesn't understand. She doesn't understand that death is not the enemy. That would be too easy. She doesn't understand. She has too much faith in the power, in the omnipotence of love. Love me and you'll be protected. Love each other, and all will be well. Suffering will leave man's earth forever. Who said that? Christ, probably. He also believed too much in love. As for me, love or death, I didn't care. I was able to laugh when I thought about either. Now, too, I could burst out laughing. Yes, but the muscles in my face didn't obey me. I was too cold. It had been cold on the day, no, the evening. That evening, when I met Kathleen for the first time.
a winter evening. Outside, a wind sharp enough to cut through walls and trees.
"Come along," Shimon Yanai told me. "I'd like you to meet Halina."
"Let me listen to the wind," I answered. I wasn't in a talkative mood. "The wind has more to say than your Halina. The sound of the wind carries the regrets and prayers of dead souls. Dead souls have more to say than living ones." Shimon Yanai, the most beautiful mustache in Palestine, not to say in the whole Middle East, wasn't paying any attention to what I was saying.
"Come," he said, his hands in his pockets. "Halina is waiting for us."
I gave in. I thought, perhaps Halina is a dead soul, too. We were standing in the lobby during an intermission at the ballet in Paris. The Roland Petit Company, or the Marquis de Cuevas, I no longer remember.
"Halina must be an attractive woman," I said as we crossed the lobby to get to the bar.
"What makes you think that?"
asked Shimon Yanai, who seemed amused.
"The way you're dressed tonight. You look like a bum."
I liked to tease him. Shimon was in his 40s, tall, bushy hair, blue and dreamy eyes. He never wanted to be taken seriously. "You spend hours in front of the mirror mussing your hair, spoiling the knot in your tie, rumpling your trousers," I would often tell him, ironically but with affection. There was something pathetic about his love for the Bohemian. I knew him well because he came to Paris often and gave me tips for the newspaper. He liked to be with journalists. He needed them. He was the Paris representative of the Hebrew resistance movement. The State of Israel hadn't been born yet. And he didn't hesitate to admit that the press could be helpful to him. Halina was waiting for us at the bar, a glass in her hand. She was 30-ish. Thin, narrow face. Pale, with the eternally frightened look of a woman fighting with her past. We shook hands.
"I thought you'd be older,"
she was smiling awkwardly.
"I am," I said. "At times I am as old as the wind."
Halina laughed. She didn't really know how to laugh. When she laughed, she could break your heart. Her laughter was as haunting as a dead soul.
"I'm serious," she said. "I read your articles. They are written by a man who has come to the end of his life, to the end of his hopes."
"That is a sign of youth," I answered. "The young today don't believe that someday they'll be old. They are convinced they'll die young. Old men are the real youngsters of our generation. They at least can brag about having had what we do not have, a slice of life called youth."
The young woman's face became still paler.
"What you are saying is dreadful."
I burst out laughing. But my laughter must have sounded forced. I didn't feel like laughing. Not any more than like talking. "Don't listen to me," I said. "Shimon will tell you my words are never serious. I'm playing, that's all. Playing at frightening you. But you mustn't pay any attention. What I'm saying is just wind." I was going to leave them, on the usual pretext of an urgent phone call to make, when I noticed a worried look in Halina's eyes.
"Shimon," she exclaimed without raising her voice. "Look who is here, Kathleen."
Shimon looked to where she was pointing, and for a second, only a second, his face clouded over. His cheeks darkened as if from a painful memory.
"Go and ask her to join us," Halina said. "But she's not alone. Just for a minute she'll come."
She did come. And that's when it all started. Actually, I could easily have left while Shimon was talking to her at the other end of the lobby. My phone call was just as urgent then as it had been before. I didn't at all feel like staying. At first glance, it looked like the classic situation. Three characters, Shimon, Halina, Kathleen. Halina loves Shimon, who doesn't love her. Shimon loves Kathleen, who does not love him. Kathleen loves... I didn't know whom she loved and cared less. I was thinking, they make one another suffer in a tightly closed circle. Better not to have anything to do with it, not even as a witness. I'd never been interested in sterile suffering. Other people's suffering only attracts me to the extent that it allows man to become conscious of his strength and of his weakness, in a climate that favors rebellion. The loves of Halina and Shimon allowed nothing of the kind. "I have to go," I told Halina. She looked at me but didn't hear. She was watching Shimon and Kathleen at the end of the lobby. "I have to go," I said again. She seemed to come out of a dream, surprised to see me next to her.
"Please, stay,"
she asked, in a humble, almost humiliated tone of voice. Then she added, either to convince me or to stress her indifference, "You're going to meet Kathleen. She is an extraordinary girl. You'll see." It had become useless to resist. Kathleen and Shimon were there. "Hello, Halina," Kathleen said, in French, with a strong American accent. "Hello, Kathleen," Halina answered, barely hiding a certain nervousness. "Let me introduce a friend." Without a gesture, without a move, without saying a word, Kathleen and I looked at each other for a long time, as if to establish a direct contact. She had a long, symmetrical face, uncommonly beautiful and touching. Her nose turned up slightly, accentuating her sensuous lips. Her almond-shaped eyes were filled with a dark, secret fire, an inactive volcano. With her, there could be real communication. All of a sudden, I understood why Halina's laughter wasn't more carefree. "You already know each other?" Halina asked with her awkward smile. "You look at each other as if you knew each other." Shimon was silent. He was looking at Kathleen. "Yes," I answered. "What?" Halina exclaimed, not quite believing it. "You've already met?" "No," I answered. "But we already know each other." An imperceptible quiver went through Shimon's mustache. The situation was becoming unpleasantly tense when a warning bell suddenly rang. The intermission was over. The lobby began to empty. "Shall we see you after the show?" Halina asked. "I'm afraid not," Kathleen answered. "Someone is waiting for me." "And you?" Halina looked at me, her big eyes filled with a cold sadness. "No," I answered. "I have to make a phone call. It's urgent." Halina and Shimon went off. We were alone, Kathleen and I. "Do you speak English?" she asked me in English, as if in a hurry. "I do." "Wait for me," she said. She walked quickly to the man who was waiting at the other end of the lobby, said a few words to him. I still had a chance to leave, but why run away? And where to? The desert is the same everywhere. Souls die in it. And sometimes they play at killing the souls that are not yet dead. When Kathleen came back a few seconds later, I saw a fleeting expression of defiance and decision on her face, as if she had just completed the most important act in her life. The man she had just left and humiliated remained completely motionless and stiff, as if struck by a curse. Inside, the curtain had gone up. "Let's leave," Kathleen said in English. I felt like asking endless questions, but decided to keep them for later. "All right," I said. "Let's leave." We left the lobby hurriedly. The man stayed behind, alone. For a long time after, I was afraid to go back to that theater. I was afraid of finding him there, on the very spot where we had left him. We went down the stairs, got our coats, and went out into the street where the wind whipped us angrily. The air was clear and pure, as it is on the peaks of snowy mountains. We began to walk. It was cold. We were advancing slowly, as if to prove that we were strong and that the cold had no power over us.
Kathleen hadn't taken my arm, and I hadn't taken hers. She didn't look at me, and I didn't look at her. Either of us would have gone on walking at the same pace if the other had stopped suddenly to think or to pray. After walking silently along the Seine for an hour or two, we crossed the Pont du Châtelet, and then, when we reached the middle of the Pont Saint-Michel, I stopped to look at the river. Kathleen took two more steps and stopped too. The Seine, reflecting the sky and the lampposts, now showed us its mysterious winter face, its quiet cloudiness, where any life is extinguished, where any light dies. I looked down and thought that some day I too would die. Kathleen came closer and was about to say something. With a motion of my head, I stopped her. "Don't talk," I told her after a while. I was still thinking about death and didn't want her to talk to me. It's only in silence, leaning over a river in winter, that one can really think about death. One day I had asked my grandmother, how should one keep from being cold in a grave in the winter? My grandmother was a simple, pious woman who saw God everywhere, even in evil, even in punishment, even in injustice. No event would ever find her short of prayers. Her skin was like white desert sand. On her head she wore an enormous black shawl which she never seemed able to part with. "He who doesn't forget God isn't cold in his grave," she said. "What keeps him warm?" I insisted. Her thin voice had become like a whisper. It was a secret. "God himself." A kind smile lit up her face all the way to the shawl that covered half her forehead. She smiled like that every time I asked her a question with an obvious answer. "Does that mean that God is in the grave with the men and the women that are buried?" "Yes," my grandmother assured me. "It is He who keeps them warm." I remember that then a strange sadness came upon me. I felt pity for God. I thought, "He is more unhappy than man, who dies only once, who is buried in only one grave." "Grandma, tell me, does God die too?" "No, God is immortal." Her answer came as a blow. I felt like crying. God was buried alive. I would have preferred to reverse the roles, to think that God is mortal and man not. To think that when man acts as if he were dying, it is God who is covered with earth. Kathleen touched my arm. I jumped. "Don't touch me," I told her. "I was thinking of my grandmother, and you cannot truly remember a dead grandmother if you aren't alone, if a girl with black hair, black like my grandmother's shawl, touches your arm." Suddenly it occurred to me that my grandmother's smile had a meaning that the future was to reveal. She knew that my question did not concern her, that she would not know the cold of a grave. Her body had not been buried, but entrusted to the wind that had blown it in all directions. And it was her body, my grandmother's white and black body, that whipped my face, as if to punish me for having forgotten. "No, grandmother, no, I haven't forgotten. Every time I'm cold, I think of you. I think only of you." "Come on," Kathleen said. "Let's go. I'm getting cold." We started walking again. The wind cut our faces, but we went on. We didn't walk faster. Finally, we stopped on Boulevard Saint-Germain, opposite the Dieu Magot. Here we are, she said.
This is where you live?
Yes. Do you want to come up? I had to fight against myself not to say no. I wanted to stay with her too much, to talk to her, to touch her hair, to see her fall asleep. But I was afraid of being disappointed. Come, Kathleen insisted. She opened the heavy door and we walked up one flight to her apartment. I was cold, and I was thinking of my grandmother, whose face was white like the transparent desert sand, and whose shawl was as black as the dense night of cemeteries.
Who are you?
I could hardly hear my own voice. Thousands of needles were injecting fire into my blood. I was thirsty, I felt hot, my throat was dry, my veins were about to burst, and yet the cold hadn't left me. My body, shaken by convulsions, trembled like a tree in a storm, like leaves in the wind, like the wind in the sea, like the sea in the head of a madman, of a drunkard, of a dying man.
Who are you?
I asked again while my teeth chattered. I could feel there was someone in the room.
The nurse, said an unknown voice.
Water, I said. I'm thirsty. I'm burning. Please give me some water.
You mustn't drink, the voice said. You'll feel bad. If you drink, you'll throw up.
Against my will, I began to cry silently.
There now, the nurse said. I'm going to moisten your face.
She wiped my forehead, and then my lips with a wet towel which caught fire as it touched my skin.
What time is it?
I asked.
6 o'clock.
At night?
Yes.
I thought, when Dr. Russell came to see me, it was well before noon. 6 penicillin shots I hadn't even noticed.
Are you in pain?
The nurse asked.
I'm thirsty.
It's the fever that's making you thirsty.
Do I still have a high fever?
Yes.
How high?
High.
I want to know.
I'm not allowed to tell you. That's the rule.
The door opened. Someone came in. Whispers.
Well, my friend, what have you got to say?
Dr. Russell was trying to be casual.
I'm thirsty, doctor.
The enemy refuses to retreat, he said. It's up to you to hold out.